Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. So today we're reading from the Srimad Bhagavatam. This is the second canto, chapter 1, the first step in God realization, and we're on text number 4. So today's class is going to be entitled Atma Tattva, the truth of the self. And this class is in honor of Vidura Prabhu, and I'd like to offer also to my brother Joe. And this was also inspired by Archita Prabhu. So, Deha Patya Kala Tradisho. Deha Patya Kala Tradisho. Atma Sanyeshu. Asatsu api atmasanyeshu asatsu api tesham pramato nirhanam tesham pramato nirhanam pashyan api na pashyati Pashyanapina Pashyati Deha Patya Kala Tradishu Atma Sanyeshu Asatsu Api Tesham Pramato Nidhinam Pashyanapina Pashyati Deha Patya Kala Dradishu Atma Sanyeshu Asatsu Api Tesham Paramato Nidhanam Pashyanapina Pashyati. Pashyanapinapashyati Deha-patya-kaleshu Asasabhesasasvati Deshampamato-nidhanam Pashyanayapinashyati Deha-patya-kaladrashu Atma Saineshwa Satsabhi Tesham Pramatta Nidhanam Pashyanapi Na Pashyati Deham Pata Bhagavadishu Atma Saineshwa Masasmasri Tesham Pramatta Nidhanam Pashanapi na pashati. Vaishnavis? Deha patra kaladreshu. Atma saine svasatvapi. Tesham pamato nidhanam. Pashanapi na pashati. Dehapatya kaladrashu. Atma saine svasatvapi. Tesham pamato nidhanam. Pashanami payasati. Deapatya kaladreshu. Atma saine svasatvapi. Tesham pramatta nidhanam. Pashanapi na pashati. Dehapacha kaladrasvi. Atmasanyesha satsapi. Tesham pramato nidhanam. Pashanapina pashati. Deha. Body. Apatya. Children. Kalatra. Wife. Adishu. And in everything in relation to them. Atma. Own. Sainyeshu. Fighting soldiers. Asatsu. Fallible. Api. In spite of. Tesham, all of them. Pramata, too attached. Nidhanam, destruction. Pashan, having been experienced. Api, although. Na, does not. Pashati, see it. Translation. Persons devoid of atma-tattva do not inquire into the problems of life. Being too attached to the fallible soldiers like the body, children and wife, although sufficiently experienced, they still do not see their inevitable destruction. Please repeat. Persons devoid of atma-tattva do not inquire into the problems of life. Being too attached to the fallible soldiers, like the body, children, and wife. Although sufficiently experienced, they still do not see their inevitable destruction. Purport. This material world is called the world of death. Every living being, beginning from Brahma, whose duration of life is some thousands of millions of years, down to the germs who live for a few seconds only, is struggling for existence. Therefore, this life is a sort of fight with material nature, which imposes death upon all. In the human form of life, a living being is competent enough to come to an understanding of this great struggle for existence. By being too attached to family members, society, country, etc., he wants to win over the invincible material nature by the aid of bodily strength, children, wife, relatives, etc. So it's interesting how Srila Prabhupada talks about here in this paragraph about a battle. It's like a battle. We'll talk more about that. Although he is sufficiently experienced in the matter by dint of past experience, and previous examples of his deceased predecessors. He still does not see that the so-called fighting soldiers, like the children, relatives, society members, and countrymen, are all infallible in the great struggle. Okay, that's a big difference. Society members and countrymen are all fallible in the great struggle. One should examine the fact that his father or his father's father has already died, and that he himself is therefore also sure to die. And similarly, his children, who are the future fathers of their children, will also die in due course. No one will survive in the struggle with material nature. The history of human society definitely proves it, yet the foolish people still suggest that in the future they will be able to live perpetually with the help of material science. This poor fund of knowledge exhibited by human society is certainly misleading, and it is all due to ignoring the constitution of the living soul. So here, there's a nice, interesting analogy of how the universe is here to teach us. It's like the universe becomes into a university. So we'll talk more about that also. Continuing the purport. This material world exists only as a dream due to our attachment to it. Otherwise, the living soul is always different from the material nature. The great ocean of material nature is tossing with the waves of time, and the so-called living conditions are something like foaming bubbles, which appear before us as bodily self, wife, children, society, countrymen, etc. Due to a lack of knowledge of the self, we become victimized by the force of ignorance and thus spoil the valuable energy of human life in a vain search after permanent living conditions, which are impossible in this material world. Our so-called friends, relatives, and wives and children are not only fallible, but also bewildered by the outward glamour of material existence. As such, they cannot save us. Still, we think that we are safe within the orbit of family, society, or country. So this brings up to mind about our current culture of materialism and how that's affecting us. So we'll talk about that more also. So continuing the purport. The whole materialistic advancement of human civilization is like the decoration of a dead body. Everyone is a dead body flapping only for a few days. And yet all the energy of human life is being wasted in the decoration of this dead body. Sukadeva Goswami is pointing out the duty of the human being after showing the actual position of bewildered human activities. Persons who are devoid of the knowledge of Atma Tattva are misguided by those who are devotees of the Lord and have perfect realization of transcendental knowledge are not bewildered. So here there's such a promise of this material improvement, but yet we'll see what the research has shown and what we can see from our own experiences. So here, as Prabhupada mentioned in the purport, that this life is sort of a fight with material nature, which imposes upon us all this death. So, as I mentioned, the universe becomes like a university, but actually the battle of the Kurukshetra war is actually turned by Krishna into a classroom for Krishna. So it's very interesting. So again, Srila Prabhupada is saying, therefore, this life is sort of a fight with material nature, which imposes death upon all. In the human form of life, a living being is competent enough to come to an understanding of this great struggle for existence. But being too attached to family members, society, country, etc., he wants to win over the invincible material nature by the aid of bodily strength, children, wife, relatives, etc. So this of Krishna transforming the battlefield into a classroom is very interesting, and it demonstrates that we can utilize every circumstance as a setting for educating us. And the wisdom of the Bhagavad Gita actually enables us to do that. We can refine, it's described here, I'm getting some inspiration from, what's his name, I forget. There's a devotee who wrote a book on Advaita Chandra Prabhu. No, not Advaita Chandra. Chandra. He's written this Gita Daily, spiritual scientist, Bhagavad Gita. Chaitanya Charan, yeah. So this is some inspiration from him, so which he's inspired also this class. So it's very nice. And there's a section here I'd like to read where he says, so the Gita, it enables us similar to refine the various battle-like situations that confront us in our daily life. If we accept Krishna as our teacher by learning the Gita, he will use the unlikeliness of settings to impart the most unforgettable of lessons, transforming our life journey into an adventure. In ever-increasing wisdom, learning from life will become the living and enlivening reality of our life. So he actually wrote a book on leadership from the Bhagavad Gita. So this is where we're all trying to become leaders in our own life and also have become leaders of society so we can actually have a better world. So here, this is interesting. I like to also read this here where he's showing how it's so practical. Krishna is so practical. So many people feel that spiritual knowledge is too otherworldly and so is impractical or irrelevant. Given the urgent practical demands of this world, leaders especially are often under much more pressure than others. To address such concerns, the Bhagavad Gita's spiritual message is delivered in a setting that is eminently this worldly and calls for the most urgent practical action. By showing how its spiritual wisdom solaced and empowered a responsible head of state, the Gita illustrates poignantly the universal applicability of its teachings. If a person on the battlefield spared time for gaining its spiritual wisdom and found it relevant, practical, and empowering, then no one needs to doubt the practicality of the Gita's message, and no circumstance needs to warrant relegating that message to the to-be-done later category. So this is very nicely described there. So here, as we mentioned, the universe as a university. Chaitanya Charan is very, very expert in coining phrases that bring out a lot of philosophical points. And he shows here how this universe, we're actually learning from it. So he says here, one should examine the fact that his father, or this is Prabhupada speaking in the purport, how we're learning, we should learn from the experiences in life. So Prabhupada says, one should examine the fact that his father or his father's father has already died, and that he himself is therefore also sure to die. And similarly, his children, who are the future fathers of their children, will also die in due course of time. So he's explaining here, nobody will survive. Even in the history of the whole, society, the world, nobody has survived. So he says here that science is not going to help you, your family members, so many things. This poor fund of knowledge exhibited by human society is certainly misleading, and it is all due to ignoring the constitution of the living soul. So again, as whatever happens to us is meant to stimulate our learning. There's actually a higher order in life's events. And this world we're living in is like an arena for our spiritual evolution. So essentially, yes, the universe is like a university. So every moment we have is an opportunity to grow in wisdom and love. So this way we can actually gain the purpose of life. And Prabhupada also mentions in the purport that due to a lack of knowledge of the self, we become victimized by the force of ignorance and thus spoil the valuable energy of human life in a vain search after permanent living conditions, which are impossible in this material world. So this is our culture. We are a lack of knowledge of what it means and how to live in the material world. So our current culture is actually emphasizing materialism. And it's actually lured us into marginalizing our spiritual side, which leads to distress, disorder, even disaster. So it's actually as a responsibility of devotees, of leader society, to actually correct this wrong and leading people on the path of holistic balance, balancing the spirit and the material. So this is what it means as the word coined by Chaitanya Charan, that leaders par excellence, that we should gain these spiritual insights so that we can actually become leaders. So Prabhupada also mentions in the purport about this spiritual hunger. And he says here, the whole materialistic advancement of human civilization is like the decoration of a dead body. Everyone is a dead body flapping only for a few days, and yet all the energy of human life is being wasted in the decoration of this dead body. So there's an interesting book. It's called the... There's a researcher... He did this book called The American Paradox, Spiritual Hunger in the Age of Plenty. It's by this David G. Myers. And he says here, he did some statistics in America. And he's talking about the overall well-being across nearly half of a century from 1960 onwards. And he says, a period that corresponded with the high material prosperity. These were his findings. The divorce rate has doubled. The teen suicide rate has tripled. The recorded violent crime rate has quadrupled. The prison population has quintupled. The percentage of babies born to unmarried parents has sextupled. Depression has soared to 10 times the pre-World War II level. So this is our materialistic advancement of society. Only one-sided. So we have to harmonize the material with the spiritual. We are bi-dimensional. We're both spiritual and material. And we're souls. Ultimately, we're pure, we're free. Prabhupada says the soul has such immense power and such immense freedom. But right now we're encaged in these bodies. And in the Bhagavad Gita, its message is not that we reject the material, but we have to systematically use the material for attaining spiritual realization. So we have to actually learn how to harmonize the material with the spiritual. It's not that, you know, that we just lead these materialistic lives and forget about the spirit. Actually, it's described in the Bhagavad Gita how Krishna actually addresses Arjuna. So here he says, at the same time, Krishna is giving some transcendental knowledge, but at the same time he's saying, Arjuna is calling him very honorifics. He's saying, O hero of the Bharata dynasty. And then he's calling him tiger among men, Purusha Vyagraha. And in fact, there's like 25 names he uses to address Arjuna and refers to his bodily connections. So that's very interesting. So, you know, he wanted Arjuna to act honorably, you know, and by giving these illustrations like this of his materialistic ties. So here, so we have to understand that, you know, a leader like Arjuna, when someone is in a great, you know, stressful and challenging situation, that it's important for the leaders to actually get this groundedness, to remain calm and to be able to give transcendental knowledge and focus on solutions instead of becoming bewildered by the material energy. So how now we're going to discuss about the mind. The mind comes up a lot in the Bhagavad Gita and throughout the teachings, and actually it's referred to in our purport today. So, and the mind, people think of it as the intellect or memory or attention or determination. But actually, there's some philosopher, his name is Jay Ayer. He refused to study the mind because he said, actually, it has no locus, which means he doesn't know where it is. But actually, the Bhagavad Gita actually gives us a great understanding of what the mind is and how it's located. And it's talking about within three levels, you know, the self. There's our body, the material covering, and then there's which is like the dress, and that's what we normally identify ourselves with. But the mind is like the subtle material mechanism that interfaces between the soul and the gross material body. So we can see here in the chariot, here the driver is actually like the intelligence, but the mind is like the reins. And that's the connection, as mentioned in the Bhagavad Gita, between the soul and the senses. So we have to actually learn to actually where this mind is and how to control it. Because if we leave the mind, it can actually become, as described, as our friend or our worst enemy. So this is so important, how the mind actually, it's like a memory, remembers things that we've done in the past, and then it imagines pleasures where there's actually none, or it exaggerates insignificant pleasures till they seem irresistible. Or it imagines problems where there's none, or it exaggerates inconsequential problems till they seem insurmountable. So this is the mind. It's so powerful. It does that. It distracts us in so many different ways to make us worry, to make us distracted, and so many different things like this. It's like a distracting companion. It's like you're driving a car and then the passenger's there and he's telling you, oh, let's go here, let's go there. No, take this exit, do that exit. And you're like, you could just, you know, ignore it, or you can actually think, oh, that's me. Oh, yeah, let's do that. He can identify with that person and think that's actually him. And there's a nice metaphor that's given to by Chaitanya Charan. I'd like to mention that he talks about the ventriloquist. And you know what a ventriloquist, he projects his voice into someone else or some object. So you think he's close to him, so you know it looks like his voice is coming from here, because he has that tendency to do that. So he's describing the mind is like that also. And this is what he says. While ordinary ventriloquists may perform a show for us to see, the mind makes us its show. Ordinary ventriloquists may project their voice to inanimate objects for entertaining onlookers, but the mind projects its voice onto us and makes us believe that its voice is our voice. Because we're often unaware of the mind's insidious tactics, we fall prey to its ventriloquism and act out its selfish desires, assuming they are our desires. Only later, when the short-lived pleasure of acting out ends and the consequences start registering, and we ask, why did I do that? So this is interesting, this metaphor. So, but how do we do that? We have to actually stop the mind. Because you hear the passengers telling you, why don't you do this? You know, and then you're thinking, okay, yeah, it's like the second person. But eventually you hear it so much that you're thinking, you're saying, oh, I will do that. So this is how the mind makes it feel like it's you actually talking, but it's not. It's a separate entity. So we have to catch that in the beginning so that we don't become a victim of its tricks. So here we're going to talk about the trajectory to self-destruction. And this is in the Bhagavad Gita. There's a couple of verses there that's described. While contemplating the object of the senses, a person develops attachment for them, and from such attachment, lust develops, and from lust, anger arises. From anger, complete delusion arises, and from delusion, bewildered the memory. And when memory is bewildered, intelligence is lost. When intelligence is lost, one falls down again into the material pool. So there's actually eight stages of this path, this trajectory to self-destruction. And this verse, it's describing them. So let's just talk about those a little bit. How this contemplation, use the analogy of an alcoholic, he starts considering the prospect of drinking. Oh, look at that. Doesn't that look good? So he's contemplating. That's the jayato. And then there's attraction, the sangha. He starts to feel, oh, that drink is very enjoyable. It's nice. You can relax and enjoy. So he's like attracted to the results like that. And then comes his kama, obsession. So he starts feeling strongly infatuated by it. I want it now. And then comes what? Krodha. He becomes irritated and starts, you know, thinking that nothing's going to stop me from getting this. You know, who can stop me? This is what I want. I'm going to take it. So then there's this, he becomes disillusioned and he's thinking this is the somaha. So he gets completely confused about what's good and what's bad. And he says, I don't need anybody's advice. I know what to do. So this is that delusion. And then this comes the oblivion, which is the smriti brahma. So he forgets the hangover. He forgets the bondage and the misery that's going to come. From the past, he's had the experience. But he's just thinking, oh, there's so much pleasure here. Why should I not enjoy? And then comes what? The stupefaction. The buddhi naso. So he loses an intellectual capacity to discern before acting, and he decides to act on the spur of the moment. I'm going to drink right now. So, and then what comes last is the destruction, the pranashati. So he falls headlong into a relapse and he just wallows in it. And then he wakes up the next day with an awful headache, and then he, you know, has to throw up and so many things. So this is the stage. So, so that's the mind's voice. It gets louder and louder and louder. And it's, you begin to think that, oh, that's me. I'm thinking. So we have to actually not identify with this mind and then just try to catch it before it catches you. So this is important. We have to protect ourselves. And so this is the mind. And there's so many techniques given to us in the Bhagavad Gita and throughout the Srimad Bhagavatam is how we can actually do that. And some people say, you know, by, you know, you could write, keep writing, you could do meditation, you know, chanting mantras, reading Srimad Bhagavatam, all these things help the mind. So here, you know, we're going to go to Yamaraj and the Yamadutas, which is a very important verses that relate to today's class. This is from the sixth canto, and we're going to be reading text 28 to 29 on the third chapter, Yamaraj meets the Yamadutas. So this is one of the verses I have up here. Paramahamsas are exalted persons who have no taste for material enjoyment and who drink the honey of the Lord's lotus feet. My dear servants, bring to me for punishment only persons who are averse to the taste of that honey, who do not associate with Paramahamsas and are attached to family life and worldly enjoyment, which form the path to hell. So in the purport, Srila Prabhupada talks about here how the Yamadutas didn't approach the devotees. And they went to Yamaraj and he was telling them who to bring to him. The people that are who are too attached to household life, that are too attached to household life just for sex and trying to enjoy in that way. So then there's another verse that Prabhupada quotes in that purport from the Srimad Bhagavatam 2.1.4, which is our verse today. And here he translates it in a different way. Such persons complacently believe that their nations, communities, or families can protect them. unaware of that all of such fallible soldiers will be destroyed in due course of time. In conclusion, one should try to associate with persons who engage in devotional service 24 hours a day. So there's another verse here where he says, "My dear servants, please bring to me only those sinful persons who do not use their tongues to chant the holy name and qualities of Krishna, whose hearts do not remember the lotus feet of Krishna even once, and whose heads do not bow down even once before Lord Krishna. Send me those who do not perform their duties toward Vishnu, which are only duties in human life. Please bring to me such fools and rascals." So in that purport, Srila Prabhupada mentions how from the Madhya Lila verse, he says here, he quotes it, "Human society is meant to follow strictly the Vanashram Dharma, which divides society into four social divisions, Brahmana, Kshatriya, Vaishya, and Sudra, and four spiritual divisions, Brahmacharya, Grihastha, Vanaprastha, and Sannyas. Vanashram Dharma easily brings one nearer to Lord Vishnu, who is the only true objective in human society." And then Prabhupada quotes that verse, "Nate vidhu gatim hi Vishnum," that people do not know what their real self-interest is, to return home back to Godhead. So this is where Prabhupada also brings up that point where Yamaraj is advising the Yamadutas to only bring those who have forgotten their duties toward Vishnu. So this is that at the truth of the self and of the super self. They have to know that in order to go back. So here's another story where Narada and Angira are instructing King Chitraketu. And this is a very nice verse. We'll read a couple verses which relate to today's class. And here is this first verse. "My dear king, now you are actually experiencing the misery of a person who has sons and daughters. O king, owner of the state of Surasena, one's wife, his house, the opulence of his kingdom, and his various other opulences and objects of sense perception are all the same in that they are temporary. One's kingdom, military power, treasury, servants, ministers, friends, and all relatives are all causes of fear, illusion, lamentation, and distress. They are like a Gandharva Nagara, a non-existent place that one imagines to exist in the forest. Because they are impermanent, they are no better than illusions, dreams, and mental concoctions." So we're seeing here how the Srimad Bhagavatam is giving us knowledge and educating us from stories and pastimes that are even beyond the universe, from some of the greatest stories. So this is the greatness of the Bhagavatam. So Prabhupada mentions in the purport that how these things, we think that they will give us protection, but actually they're not. But only the sane man knows that they won't. So then there's another verse here from the next verses. He's describing, continuing. "These visible objects like wife, children, and property are like dreams and mental concoctions. Actually, what we see has no permanent existence. It is sometimes seen and sometimes not. Only because of our past actions do we create such mental concoctions. And because of these concoctions, we perform further activities." So Prabhupada brings up the point again in the purport that everything material is mental concoction. Imagine how that is. The mind is so powerful. And it's like a dream. And then he quotes Srila Vishnava Chakravarti Thakur, and he's using this analogy. "At night, one dreams of tigers and snakes, and while dreaming, he actually sees them. But as soon as the dream is broken, they no longer exist. Similarly, the material world is a creation of our mental concoctions. We have come to this material world to enjoy material resources, and by mental concoction, we discover many, many objects of enjoyment because our minds are absorbed in material things. That's why we receive various bodies." So this is described there. And then there's one more verse here from that pastime. Narada and Angira instructing King Chitraketu. "The living entity in the bodily conception of life is absorbed in the body, which is a combination of the physical elements, the five senses for gathering knowledge, and the five sense actions, along with the mind. Through the mind, the living entity suffers three kinds of tribulations, adibhautika, adidaivika, and adiyatmika. Therefore, this body is the source of all miseries." So Prabhupada gives a wonderful purport here for this particular verse also. But his explaining here and is quoting another verse from the Bhagavad Gita, how the living entities in this conditioned world are my eternal fragmental parts. Due to conditioned life, they're struggling very hard with the six senses, which include the mind. So we're actually part and parcel of Krishna, but because of the mind, we're actually living in the material world, thinking we want to be separate from Krishna. And so now, this is the last verse actually. Therefore, King Chitraketu, carefully consider the position of the Atma. In other words, try to understand who you are, whether your body, mind, or soul. Consider where you have come from, where you're going after giving up this body, and why you're under the control of material lamentation. Try to understand your real position in this way, and then you'll be able to give up your unnecessary attachment. You will also be able to give up the belief that this material world, or anything not directly in touch with the service to Krishna, is eternal. Thus, you will obtain peace. So in the purport, Srila Prabhupada says that this is the purpose of the Krishna consciousness movement. It's actually endeavoring to bring human society to this sober condition. We want to become sober. Prabhupada says here, the Krishna consciousness movement includes self-realization because one is first directed by Lord Krishna to understand that one is not the body, but the owner of the body. And then when you understand that simple fact, you can direct yourself towards the goal of life. So then we have some more information from the 11th canto, and this is the Maharaj Nimi meets the nine Yogendras. And here's another verse here, which we'll read, which is very nicely describes today's message. Although duality of material world does not ultimately exist, the conditioned soul experiences it as real under the influence of his own conditioned intelligence. This imaginary experience of a world separate from Krishna can be compared to acts of dreaming and desiring. When the conditioned soul dreams at night of something desirable or horrible, or when he dreams, daydreams of what he would like to have or avoid, he creates a reality that has no existence beyond his own imagination. The tendency of the mind is to accept and reject various activities based on sense gratification. Therefore, an intelligent person should control the mind, restricting it from illusion of seeing things separate from Krishna. And when the mind is thus controlled, he will experience actual fearlessness. So, Prabhupada has also quoted other verses in this purport. But just for the sake of time, I'm just going to go on a little bit and go to the next instruction. This is from the Second Chance book and the chapter on death, the critical time of life. So Prabhupada mentions there some interesting analogy. And first, we'll just read one section here. Prabhupada says here that one who properly prepares for the time of death is really intelligent, while one who thinks he can remain at home forever and enjoy the association of his wife and children is a fool. In illusion, a man thinks, my bank balance, my nice house, and my family will protect me, but these cannot protect anyone. So this is nicely described. And Prabhupada uses an analogy of a businessman. And he's saying that, you know, I'm going to build this wonderful building, and then eventually I'm going to just burn it down. I'm just going to build it to burn it down. So someone would think, was that very sane? So, but no, but that's actually what we're doing. That we're thinking like that, Srila Prabhupada says. So, and then here Prabhupada says, the Krishna consciousness movement is especially meant for helping the members of human society to come to this state of full Krishna consciousness. Then at the end of life, one will simply remember Krishna. Whatever you practice throughout your life will be determined your consciousness at the time of death. So now we have Srila Prabhupada. He actually gave several lectures on this particular verse. And he's been talking about how, and then he mentions symptoms of one who is actually transcendental, one who's situated on this platform. And there's so many nice information given to us by Srila Prabhupada. And here he says, Prabhupada says, so we should be very clever to understand about the spiritual life. We should not be dragged down to this material conception of life due to this false affection. This bodily affection is false affection because the body will not exist. So that's very nicely described. And Prabhupada uses another analogy, and he says, now I've got this beautiful body. Suppose 70 years, my age, 70 years before, the body has no existence. And say after 5 to 10 years more, the body will have no existence. So for 70 or 80 years, this manifestation of the body. So what is it? It's just like a bubble in the ocean, he describes, which is amazing. You can see when you walk on the ocean, you see all these bubbles come. And one day it was coming, and you see they're there for a brief time, and then the waves go back, and then all that foam just stays there, and it just dries up right there. And you see all these lines along the beach of just dried up bubbles. So this is what it's like in the material world. So this is a very nice lecture. There's a lot of nice lectures Srila Prabhupada gave, but we don't have time for all those. So anyway, we'll end with this, is that how we actually have to raise our own bows in this fight of this material world. So we have to harmonize, you know, the human will with the divine will. And it doesn't have to be just restricted to activities, you know, like spiritual activities. It can encompass all our activities, whatever professional activities we're doing, you know, as leaders, as fathers, as mothers, as whatever we're doing, then we can do it in the spirit of service to Krishna and the service to humanity. So in that way we become instruments of the divine, and therefore we can witness the empowerment of the divine in our activities. So analogy is like Arjuna's bow can said to represent his determination, his will to shoulder his responsibility as a social leader. So when he put aside his bow, that represents his inability to persevere in the midst of adversity. So often life's battles, they can be so perplexing and overwhelming that they make us lose heart. And we cast aside our metaphorical bows. And then we sink into confusion and dejection. But after hearing the Bhagavad Gita, Arjuna, he became surcharged with this supreme hope. And he was grounded in wisdom and animated by devotion. So that hope inspired him to stand firm and tall, and he raised his bow, and he was ready to respond gallantly in the battlefield. So this is his restoration of his morale. So this is the Gita wisdom that we can get to restore us to our determination, to inspire us to meet life's challenges with confidence, with courage. And it's very nicely described. Mahatma Gandhi, he actually, we have that quote from him, and he did this, he mentioned that very well. He said, when doubts haunt me, when disappointments stare me in the face, I can see not one ray of hope on the horizon. I turn to Bhagavad Gita and find a verse to comfort me, and I immediately begin to smile in the midst of overwhelming sorrow. So this same comfort and confidence awaits all of us, you know, to open ourselves to this Atma Tattva, this Gita wisdom. So now, I'd like to end now, and I don't think we have time for questions. So you just want to talk about Vidura? Okay, so now... Okay, so after class, if anybody has any questions or comments. But now we'd like to mention some things about Vidura Prabhu.
Hare Krishna. Thank you, Gaurachandra Prabhu. So we just want to spend a few minutes here just to kind of remind everybody about Vidura Prabhu. He's the father of Prema Prabhu. Vidura, he moved to New Dwarka in the 90s. In the 90s, wasn't it? Yeah. I met Vidura many years back before then. But I think what's really important is that Vidura Prabhu, he could have lived with Krishna Prema in a very nice situation and being taken care of and going on with his life. But at a very ripe age in the 70s, actually, he asked, no, I want to move to the New Dwarka Temple. So he insisted upon it. I remember that he approached me several occasions, can I move to the New Dwarka community? And we were very concerned because we never had anybody that old moving into the community. We didn't know what to expect. So, but anyway, he was firm in his conviction, and he did beat me down, and I surrendered. And so he did move in, and with his wife, Manjari, very nice, the disciples of Tamal Krishna Maharaj, very devoted. One of the reasons why he moved into the community is because he wanted to serve Rukmini and Dwarkadish. He was very adamant about that. He wanted to go on the altar, do the pujas as much as he could. So he did get that opportunity. For several years there, he was on the altar, Mangalartik and sometimes Rajbhogartik. Very, very determined and very devotional in his service. And so this went on for several years. Pedit and I, I'm sure many other devotees, had the opportunity to visit Vidura in his little apartment in 3765 and partake of some prasad cooked by Manjari. And usually it was a feast. My joke was that, you know, at that time I was up in age, but she forgot that I was up in age. And she thought I was still 20 or something, because she'd feed me like I was a 20-year-old. And she insisted upon it, although we appreciated it. It was very, very nice. It was a wonderful, loving exchange. And Vidura Prabhu, he would be in the sideline edging us on. Come on, you can do it. No problem. Take another one. Another dosa. Another idli. Take some more sambar. So he was like the cheerleader. So when you went in there, you got kind of surrounded. And you had to take. And if you didn't, then it was like, oh, you wimp. So it was kind of, it was beautiful. Trying to reiterate this, and it's hard to show how it happened, but it's, the idea was that it was very, very Krishna conscious, very, very sweet. And they were very, very humble. And they just wanted to please you when you came to their home. They really wanted you to be happy and satisfied. So that was really what kind of struck me, and I'm sure Tariq can attest to that. It was always very, very loving, and the exchange was always very happy, and you always left in a happy mood, and it was very, very Krishna conscious. So Vidura Prabhu was like that. He had a very meager income, just whatever social security he received, very meager income. He was very frugal in how he spent his Lakshmi. But somehow or other, through the years, he was able to accrue enough money, Lakshmi, to become a Nitya Seva sponsor. This is a program that I set up many years ago. The idea of the program is to come to a certain level. What we want to do is $1 million. I'll catch you a little bit later. To get $1 million, have that into an account, and then the interest of that Lakshmi would go towards the worship of Rukmini Dwarkadish in the future. In the future, something may happen here. There may not be enough Lakshmi for whatever reason, but I want to make sure that the deities always had some kind of store of money, some stock of money. And that was the idea of Nitya Seva. So the people that are involved in this, they give a one-time $10,000 donation towards that Nitya Seva. And then what we do on that particular day that they suggest or recommend, we tell the deities, let the deities know that this particular person is sponsoring all the pujas for the day and all the prasad, all, anything that was done in service to Rukmini and Dwarkadish on behalf of Viduraji. So this is how you see Nitya Seva. And he was a participant. But not only him, but also his wife, Manjari, also is a Nitya Seva on her particular day. So very, very, very sweet that they can be in that particular age group and still they want to come and give whatever they can towards the, continuing on service to the Rukmini and Dwarkadish. So very, very pleasing. And another thing that I really appreciated in terms of Vidura Prabhu was that he was always very concerned about ISKCON, the Krishna Conscious Movement. How is it going? So whenever when I had a conversation with him, he'd always ask me, well, how's it going? How's this? How's that? Very, very concerned. Very, very wanting to be a part and communicate these what's happening with ISKCON. And always very happy to know that book distribution was going on, that the deity worship was actually very high standard. So he was not just a sideline individual, but he participated. He was right in there. He wanted to be part of whatever was going on. And he gave himself in that way to the temple. And it went on for quite a few years. I don't recall, maybe 10 years or so. Huh? 13 years. 13 years we had his association in interaction here. And actually, we had to eventually come to a point where we stopped, that he couldn't go on the altar because of his age, you know, his ability to stand, and we thought there might be an accident or some fire or something. But in order to get him to retire, it was a challenge. He was so determined, and he was hurt. He actually got hurt. And it took me several months in order to, like, kind of pacify the situation. And I'm not quite sure if it ever did get pacified. But the thing is he allowed me to think that it did. And so it took a lot of negotiation and a lot of explaining. But he was that determined to stay on. He probably wanted to pass away on the altar while he was doing the arti. He would have loved it. Of course, for us, that would have been a shock. But I think for him, he would have loved it while he was doing the incense or the fan or something. And then he just fell and left his planet. He'd love it. And it didn't happen that way. But it did happen very nicely in his apartment. He did pass away there, which was really amazing. Devotees, we had devotees there for at least 2 weeks, chanting for him and for him. And you know, he was in that particular last days of his life, and then one day he did pass away. And we're trying to remember him in that way, that a very nice devotee. You know, we're glorifying him because of his devotion, not because he's just that body, but of his devotion. This is what we remember of him, his devotion of serving the Rukmini and Dwarkadish, his attitude of moving, and not only just moving into the community, but forcing himself into the community. To be here. He wanted to die here. And he could have been in a very wonderful position if he would have moved in with Krishna Prema Prabhu and Gopika. They would have taken care of him very nicely. He wouldn't have to worry about anything. But here, he insisted on being here. And it was a hardship for them, by the way. It was a hardship. It's you know, very difficult at that ripe age to do all those things for yourself. Of course, we did have devotees. I'm going to ask Archita to say a few words. We did he did have a little battery of devotees that did things for him. He was a real smart guy, you know. And you know, he knew how to, like, you know, bribe a devotee. He'd have a little bag of prasad, and then, you know, he'd work on you. He'd give you and bribe you, and then if you needed something, how could you say no? But you say, no, I'm not going to do it. No. You know, he had you connected. He had you hooked. Very smart. Like a real smart devotee. But everybody was very pleased to do it. So it wasn't really something bad. But it was very good. He used it in Krishna's service. So we're remembering Vidura Prabhu today like that. So I'm going to ask Archie to say a word.
Hi, Krishna. Vidura Prabhu Ki Jai. Most of us here, still in this room, we came out of the Western culture and we joined the International Society for Krishna Consciousness, not really knowing what we were getting into. And the rest of the society thought we were crazy. So to meet somebody like Vidura and his good wife Panjari validated the bona fides, as we would say, of the International Society for Krishna Consciousness. Because here were a couple they came out, they represented Vedic culture. They were so Vedic, they were so straight and strict. And you immediately got it, that if these individuals think that what's happening in ISKCON is bona fide and genuine and worth doing, then you know it's worth doing. They validated our existence just by associating with them. Vidura Prabhu, for me, was the epitome of determination. Very determined, as Sivas said. Once he fixed his mind on something, you couldn't change it. He was fixed, very determined. And also very sweet. And back in the day when he was here, we used to have three individual pujaris from Mangalarti. And although he was already late 80s, early 90s, he was the first one here, would come in before anyone else. And he would make all three trays for all three pujaris. So you knew if you were on Vidura's crew, you never had to worry. If you were a minute or two late, everything was set up. And he was very meticulous. Everything was done just properly. He would never forget any item. He would just, again, very fixed in his service, very fixed in his determination. And just such a wonderful individual, such a good example. But as Sivas said, despite his determination to keep serving, he was getting on in years. And I actually had to one day, by Krishna's arrangement, I was there. He was on the altar in front of Gornitai, but he was wearing a chadar, and the chadar caught fire, and he wasn't aware of it. I literally had to jump on the altar from here in the temple room and take his chadar and put it out. So that was the sign that it was time for him to stop. He wanted to go on serving the deities. And so after that, it's not that he's, you know, just slept in till 10 o'clock every day. No, he would still get up and do Mangalartik at home. They had home deities. He would get up and perform Mangalartik at home. So he was like that. And where did all that determination come from? It's not that, you know, he was... No, his determination came from his connection to Krishna through hearing. He and his wife every day religiously heard Bhagavad Gita, read Srimad Bhagavatam. And whenever I would visit them, they would discuss philosophy. They were not just, you know, talking about Brahmya Katha. No, their minds were fixed on Krishna. And they would, well, what do you think about this? And I heard this morning in the class this point. What do you think, Arjuna Prabhu? And we would discuss philosophy all the time. I had the fortune of assisting him because he always insisted on going to the bank to do his little banking business. And it was very interesting to see how he interacted with the tellers there. They knew Mr. Mehta was here, and they would have to give him their full attention. And when he would withdraw a certain amount of cash to spend in the market and stuff, and he would meticulously count every note three times. And the tellers would be rolling their eyes, but they knew they couldn't move him. He would not go aside. He would stand right in front of the window to count his money three or four times to make sure he was like that. Everything had to be perfect. Everything had to be just so. So I gained a lot on the path of devotion by my association with Vidura Prabhu, and whatever little assistance I gave him, I was glad to do it because I was receiving from him so much guidance and so much example of what a devotee should be. So Vidura Prabhu ki jai. Hare Krishna.
Okay, we'll ask Krishna Prema Prabhu to say something. Okay.
Thank you. Yeah, Vidura Prabhu was a role model for us. And every time we saw him, we were inspired to do services in a seriousness. And he has been, all throughout my life, I've been a role model. Waking up at 2:30, even joining before he's gone. And very sincere, very serious. And always he encouraged me, you know, that he said that you must chant 64 rounds. I said, how would I be able to do it? He says, wait until you retire, you'll be able to do it. So I still have a long ways to go, but yeah, he was a role model and he did a great thing. And thanks a lot to all the devotees who helped him, because it was amazing how it was a nice big family that when I used to come and chat with Archita Prabhu and Savas Prabhu and Nekatma Prabhu, it used to be really a kind of a blast, you know. We used to have a lot of fun. Anyway, thank you again. Hare Krishna.
You know, Vidura was a devotee from youth, not that he just because he met ISKCON, but he was a devotee all the time, chanting. So it wasn't something just that happened. Nita, you want to say something?
I was reflecting on my grandfather, Vidura Prabhu, today, and also appreciating that, you know, he came here at a time when he was very old, aged, and the devotees here facilitated his desire to serve and come closer to Krishna consciousness. So it's a lesson for me that one may have the desire to come closer to Krishna, but the devotees themselves are also helping that individual do that.
Vidura Prabhu Ki Jai. All right, thank you very much for your attention. Thank you.